Fossil fuels can be dirty to extract and produce. They fill the atmosphere with the carbon dioxide that we know is messing up the climate, and they need to be refined and transported before they can power our electrical plants and homes and vehicles. But man, are they great at storing energy for precisely when we need it, regardless of weather conditions. If we are ever to build a grid that gets electricity only from clean, renewable sources like wind and solar, we're going to need to find a way to set aside large amounts of power for when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. At present, there is no such thing as a battery big enough to keep a city going for days or weeks on end. And even if there were, the batteries that work best for this purpose have problems of their own. They require elements like lithium and cobalt, which are expensive, toxic, and waste and energy intensive to mine. So what do we do about this? Matthew Hudson is a contributing writer covering science and technology at The New Yorker, where you can find his article, "The Renewable Energy Revolution Will Need Renewable Storage." Matt, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
You open this article with a delightful German word, Dunkelflaute. What does that mean exactly?
So literally translated, it's dark doldrums, and it refers to the problem of low wind or cloudy skies when you need renewable energy. So if you're relying on solar cells or wind turbines, and then the weather just doesn't cooperate with you, that leads to this lull in energy or dark doldrums.
So the problem is not that we can't derive enough total energy from renewables, we just can't get them always at the time we need them.
Yes, there's sort of a mismatch between supply and demand. So even if we were to produce all of the energy that we need through sun and wind, it just might not come when we need to use it.
The fact that most of the world's electricity is consumed as soon as it's produced, honestly, it's something I hadn't fully understood before a few years ago. Does this also mean that any excess electricity produced beyond immediate demand from renewables is typically just wasted, just goes away?
Yeah, it's wasted. So one thing that was sort of interesting to think about is that electricity is one of the rare things that it costs more to store than it does to make, which, you know, think about like an iPhone, for instance, it's the opposite. It costs a lot to make, but you just put it in a drawer if you want to store it. But electricity, it's the complete opposite. So we have all these technologies for burning fossil fuels or turning wind or the sun into moving electrons. But then you want to store those moving electrons, store that electricity. Batteries get really expensive.
So as things stand now, what have energy providers relied on to carry them through cloudy days and dark nights and windless hours if they mostly want to provide energy from renewable sources?
So there are lithium ion batteries, which are like big versions of the kinds of batteries that are in electric cars. But those actually are not the most common form of storage. More than 90% of grid electricity storage is in something called pumped hydro, which is basically pumping water uphill using electricity and then letting the water come back downhill to turn a turbine and generate electricity again. So normally there'll be a low reservoir and a high reservoir, and use electricity to power a pump that shoots the water up, and then on the way back down, it moves a generator.
Okay, I have lots more questions about pumped hydro, but I'm going to set that aside for just a minute, just so that we can explain the lithium ion problem. First of all, they're not exactly a clean solution, right?
Right. So they rely on metals like lithium and cobalt that are, you have to pull them out of the ground. And mining operations are not the cleanest processes. So they can mess up the environment. They rely on a lot of water. They come from, a lot of the resources come from a few countries. And so that creates problems for supply chains if you're dependent, if the whole world is dependent on a few locations. Sometimes these countries and these companies can rely on child labor to mine these elements. And then once you're done with the batteries, there's no easy way to recycle them. So often they end up in landfills with these toxic chemicals.
Why do batteries stop being able to hold a charge after a certain number of uses?
It's the technology behind it. The ions pass back and forth through a membrane, and the materials degrade over time. So each time you recharge the battery, it's less able to hold the charge. Unlike certain things like pumped hydro, where you just the water gets pumped uphill and the water doesn't degrade. So those can last for decades. There are stations that are still going tens of years later, whereas you're unlikely to get that kind of longevity with lithium-ion batteries.
If somehow we could solve the ethical and environmental and renewability challenges, could we actually even produce enough lithium-ion batteries to store as much electricity as we're going to need in the coming years?
It's unclear how much of the elements are in reserve underground. So it's possible that we would be able to, but there's supply chain issues and then all the other issues, you know, in terms of environmental issues and the cost. Typically, a lithium-ion battery at full power will run out of juice after 3 or 4 hours. So if you want to power something overnight, then you'd need, you know, you'd use one and then follow that up with another. And so, and that would last you 8 hours. And then if there's there are dark doldrums, then you need to keep stacking them on top of each other. And that gets really expensive.
And one problem with batteries, lithium-ion batteries, is that they're not great at storing dense amounts of energy. Can you explain what that means exactly?
Well, they're not as dense as fossil fuels. So gasoline, for instance, is really dense, like 1 gallon of gas. If you burn that internal combustion engine, that provides a lot of power. Electric vehicles are really heavy because they require big batteries. And even then, they can only take you like 200 or 300 miles. So batteries are actually more dense than some things like pumping water, but not as dense as gasoline.
And the density thing is also a problem with compressed air energy storage, right? How do those systems work in principle?
So compressed air, a lot of these systems, alternatives to lithium-ion batteries for grid energy storage, rely on sort of mechanistic or physical mechanisms, like lifting things up high, relying on gravity, or compressing things or heating things up. So compressed air relies on, it's like blowing up a balloon. You can exert energy to force water into a balloon, and then you will let the air out of the balloon, and it can, you know, push something, like push a piece of paper or something. So compressed air, you just pressurize air using electricity to power a pump, and then you let the air decompress, and then that spins a fan, a turbine blade, which powers a generator and produces electricity. But it's not as dense as batteries, and definitely not as dense as gasoline. So to get a large amount of stored energy, you need an underground cavern. So these would be really big, and there are a few plants that use them. So you could be walking around on top of one of these caverns without knowing it, and there'd just be a large amount of energy stored underneath you.
All right. Thank you for going with me on that tangent. I want to go back to pumped hydro. You describe one such facility in Virginia, which is kind of an astonishing setup. I didn't know such a thing existed. Will you describe this place?
Yeah. So it's basically two reservoirs, like two lakes that have been created, one at the bottom of a small mountain, one higher up. I think it's a quarter mile above. And they're sort of picturesque, just look like normal lakes surrounded by trees on a hillside. But water can pass through millions of gallons a minute, just going up and down, providing, storing, and providing energy.
So that water that is pumped up, it would seem like that takes a lot of energy to send it into the upper lake.
Yes. And so that's sort of the idea. Can you, if you have a lot of excess energy, you have a place to put it. So then you pump a lot of water uphill. And then when it comes back down, you can get most of that energy back. It's not 100% efficient, so it's not like a perpetual motion machine. But you're probably going to get, somewhere around 70% of the energy back.
Okay, so that sounds like a great solution. Why is it unreasonable, perhaps, to imagine every community could rely exclusively on a system like this to store power?
Yeah, construction of pumped hydro plants peaked in the US around the 70s for a few reasons. One, they're really expensive to construct and they can take 10 years or more. These are really big projects. Another is that people don't want them in their backyards. There's sort of a NIMBY problem. Another is that you can't build them everywhere. You need the right landscape, you need the right geology where you have a place. Two good places, a low place and a high place next to each other, where you can just to build a lake. So if you're in a flat area or a well-populated area, you're not going to be able to build one of these plants. So they'll only be able to provide energy for or store energy in certain parts of the country.
So there are variations on pumped hydro. What is QuidNet's solution?
So QuidNet is compressed water. So they use technology similar to fracking, the fracking industry. Whereas fracking, you pump liquid underground and it sort of breaks up rock. And then that releases natural gas, which comes up through a well, and you capture that natural gas and burn it. So here they use some of the same pumping technology. But they figured out a way to pump the water underground and then contain it. In they call it a lens. It's sort of just a space between layers of rock, where they can sort of seal the inside, so it acts as an underground reservoir. So they pump the water underground under high pressure, and then later they can let the water come back up, and it spins a turbine and turns a generator and produces electricity again.
So, do those reservoirs shaped like lenses, are they naturally occurring in a lot of places, or do these have to be gouged out and built?
Neither. So basically, they find places where they look at the layers between rocks. And so when they pump the water underground, it basically seeps into, it seeps between layers of rock and expands them, kind of pushes them apart. So then there's sort of distension. The rocks want to return to their normal position and squeeze the water out. Then also the weight of the rock above pushes down on the water.
So, Matt, we were talking about QuidNet, this company, and its system of pumped hydro, which is kind of a green take on fracking in a lot of ways. How does it happen that there is less energy loss with a system like QuidNet's than with the one in Virginia that relies on two different lakes?
That's a good question. It's hard to predict the efficiency of these kinds of things. A lot of it has to do with the friction of fluids passing along the pathways or passing through pipes, or the kinds of mechanics used, the generators or the pumps, or the kind of heat loss from these kinds of things. So there's no simple answer to that question.
How water intensive is a system like this? Is like a closed loop of water able to be used indefinitely?
Yes. So for both pumped hydro, where you're pumping something uphill, and then QuidNet, where you're pumping water underground, the idea is to keep using the same water over and over again. So that's why one can think of these things as renewable storage. Whereas batteries, they're sort of renewable, but over time they degrade and then they're hard to recycle. So these types of storage are more renewable than batteries are.
Hi, I'm Micaela Rodriguez, a podcast producer at KERA. Public radio allows listeners to learn every day and approach decisions with facts and neighbors with empathy. But this vital service is only possible thanks to the community that invests in it. There's real power in having access to these conversations and stories. Invest in them today at kera.org and ensure the member campaign's success.
Where could Quidnet's technology potentially be installed? And like, how much space would its facilities or campuses or whatever you call them require to store sufficient energy to power something like a medium-sized city?
Yeah, so one pump is relatively small. The one that I visited, it was sort of, you know, 10 feet tall and maybe like a couple feet by a couple feet. But then they also require a pond above ground, which is, you know, it could be sort of picturesque, but it does take space. So water from this pond would be pumped underground and then come back up. So you could have them not necessarily in an urban area, but you would put them in more rural areas outside of cities. They have a project they're working on with San Antonio to provide energy storage for San Antonio.
In fact, Quidnet is headquartered in Texas, which infamously, you know, suffered a pretty catastrophic energy breakdown early last year during this epic winter storm that froze the entire state. How robust, does anybody know how robust this technology is in times when other sources might break down?
Yeah, so this would improve, this would help the overall grid become more robust. So if, for instance, when Texas lost power, the natural gas turbines, natural gas power plants shut down. But if you have energy storage like this, this could keep providing energy. It could possibly prevent the system from shutting down in the first place, by lowering demand in certain areas and sort of distributing the power output across different parts of the grid.
So everything you've told us so far about Quidnet sounds pretty appealing. Are there potential downsides to rolling out this technology at scale around the country?
Well, it's not going to work in all parts of the country. You need a certain geology, a certain rock structure underground. The downsides, I can't think of any clear downsides, especially considering the upsides, which would be that it would help it would enable the use of renewable power production. It would help you use more solar or wind power.
And the Department of Energy is really interested, right, in incentivizing companies like Quidnet and other energy storage innovators to come up with new solutions. What is the DOE trying to do to get more people interested in figuring out how to solve these problems?
Yeah, so a lot of these new technologies, there's still a lot of research needed to figure out the science, to figure out the technology. And so they're not ready to be expanded on a wide scale. So companies don't really want to invest in things that might not work out. So the DOE is funding a lot of these projects just to, and some of them won't work, but they're funding a lot of different solutions so people can figure out which things work best and which things work best in various scenarios, and get them to a place where other companies will sort of pick them up from there and distribute them widely.
You looked into a Canadian company called HydroStar. What are they doing to try and address the energy storage issue?
So HydroStar, I just want to make sure I don't confuse them with HiVue. So HydroStar uses compressed air tanks. They basically just pressurize air into tanks. And then when the air expands out of the tanks, it comes out quickly and turns turbine blades, which then powers generators. So, and then there's also,
Oh, continue. I think you were about to start talking about HiVue, right?
Yeah. So then HiVue, they use a similar method, but they chill the air to be, you know, a couple hundred degrees below zero, which then turns the air into a liquid, which takes up much less space than gaseous air. they store the liquid air in tanks, and then they can just sort of open up the nozzle and warm it up a little bit, and it expands rapidly into a gas, which then turns a turbine and generates electricity.
That sounds great. It sounds really clean. Does a solution like Hiviews create any kind of explosion hazard?
Not like a fiery explosion. The worst that would happen would be, I don't know, if a tank were to rupture or something, then it would just let air out really quickly. And if there were a person standing there, then that person could be injured. But they're relying on technologies that are decades old. These are just very reliable industrial processes, like air tanks and liquefied air, which is actually a technology that's, over 100 years old.
When you visited that energy vault site in, I think it was Switzerland, they were using blocks as a medium to store energy. Why might those be better than something like water, which is also heavy?
Well, it's convenient in that you can build these anywhere. It's not so reliant on the geography. You don't need to sort of build reservoirs at the bottom and the top of a mountain. You could build one of these facilities on completely flat ground. So it's and just using regular building codes, just like building a warehouse or a factory somewhere. And concrete, so the blocks are not actually concrete, because that is more expensive, a lot more expensive than water. So they have a way to glue together. It's mostly dirt. There's some cement in there and some other chemicals in there, but it's mostly dirt, which makes it not as cheap as water, but still pretty cheap.
And do these sites require a lot of human management as they proceed, or do you just sort of need someone to oversee operations and they kind of run on their own?
The idea is to not require a lot of human management. So the Energy Vault plan, they haven't built one of these facilities yet, but the idea is for it to be mostly automated and to use a lot of artificial intelligence to figure out the amount of power coming in and the amount of power that needs to go out. And so it would just completely coordinate all of the elevators and the trolleys, which would just be too complicated for a person to try to manually control. So it would use very complex software to automate all of that stuff.
Matt, what potential do these technologies we've been talking about have for parts of the world that don't already have existing power grids set up around older methods of electricity generation? Is there a benefit to sort of starting from scratch with this stuff?
Yeah, so we're kind of the US is held back by this kind of decrepit grid system. It's just not very reliable, and it's balkanized, and we're dependent on fossil fuels. There's some countries that are perhaps leapfrogging a lot of that. So sort of developing countries in Africa, for instance, whereas they can kind of start fresh and build renewable energy, build solar power and wind farms. And along with that, they can build storage, which of course, if most of your energy is coming from sort of intermittent renewables like wind and solar, you're going to need storage. And so storage is very helpful there. And they'll also need it for if they want to build an industrial economy, because factories are going to need reliable power to keep running 24/7. Companies aren't going to want to invest in building facilities there if they don't have continuous reliable energy.
How do flow batteries work?
Flow batteries are, they keep the electrolytes separate from the membranes, separate from the part of the battery that generates electricity from the electrolytes. So you can have separate tanks as large as you want containing the electrolytes, and then they just flow through the battery. So they're not limited to 3 or 4 hours. You can make them last as long as you want.
When you hear about all these possibilities, does it seem to you there's no question that we will eventually figure this out? Or are there still enough challenges to doing this that it's going to take some, you know, concerted ongoing effort and, frankly, luck?
All of the above. I think it's going to take a lot of effort and a lot of luck, and we will figure it out. There will always be snafus and problems, and you know, just like with today's technologies, there are side effects. Sometimes we have blackouts. That's a possibility. It's a certainty that we're increasing global warming. As we switch these new technologies, you know, there are possibilities and you know, upsides and downsides. But I think definitely more upsides, and it's worth the investment, and it's worth the struggle to figure out the solutions.
Why is scalability such a common challenge among people trying to figure this out?
Because we use a lot of energy.
That simple.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So will there likely be lots of sort of local energy storage solutions, or will most of these be happening at the level of sort of the grid and the energy distributors?
I think it will happen at all different levels. So right now, there are three main types of customers for energy storage. One are the independent power producers, companies that may run solar plants or wind turbines, or even nuclear or coal or gas. Then there are the utilities that distribute the power between the power producers and the customers. And then there are the customers. So if you run a big data center or a factory or a desalination plant, you want continuous power so you can run it 24/7. So if you're relying on wind or solar power, you're going to want some, you know, some storage, and you may want it on site. There might even be smaller customers, especially in like remote areas or islands or small towns. So you can imagine, you know, they might not need a sort of a cavern of compressed air or hydrogen, but they might have a use for a smaller solution. It could be lithium-ion batteries or it could be something else. And so there are different types of customers on all scales.
Matt, is an all renewable energy future, do people think it's likely to coalesce around one particular solution or employ a variety of different methods for storing power? And how important will it be to sort of for one idea or another to gain dominance?
I don't think it's important for one idea to gain dominance. And I don't think we want one, because there are different types of needs, and each one could serve a slightly different purpose. So for instance, if you have the right landscape, you might use pumped hydro and sort of build those reservoirs. Or if you need something with high response time, you might use flywheels. So different types of landscapes, different sizes, different relationships with risk or levels of investment or uncertainty. We might narrow down the options as we move forward. So instead of having, you know, dozens, we might end up with like 10. But I think it's necessary to have a variety of different options.
One upside in all this reporting you did, a political science you talked to noted that the issues around energy storage and how this might work are so far not polluted by politics to nearly the same extent as energy sources, right? Do you use solar? Do you use wind? Do you use petroleum? Can we assume that safe space will last for this industry?
I don't. It's tough to make assumptions about politics and what's going to be politicized or tied to a certain ideology or you know, a noteworthy politician can say one bad word about something and poison it for a lot of people. But I think right now we're fortunate in that people realize that it's something that benefits everyone. It's sort of neutral, like transmission lines. So whether you support coal or solar, storage fortifies the entire grid. So even look at Texas, which was highly reliant on fossil fuels and still is, but perhaps better storage could have prevented that massive blackout in Texas.
Any sense of how long it might be before this kind of storage technology is available throughout the U.S.?
It'll be slow going. It's going to roll out over decades, because it'll take decades to replace most of the fossil fuel plants we have now. We're still building them, and then the ones that we have last decades, so it would be expensive to just shut them off and never use them again. So as those ramp down, energy storage will ramp up.
Matthew Hudson is a contributing writer covering science and technology at The New Yorker, where you can find his article, "The Renewable Energy Revolution Will Need Renewable Storage." Matt, this has been fascinating. Thanks for making time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You can like our page on Facebook, on Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think, and the podcast is available where you get podcasts. You just have to search for KERA Think and subscribe. If you want to catch up on our website, that is at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.